Triangle Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Triangle Productions run of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche, starting November 28th and ending on December 20th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. This is a comedic look at the window of 1956's Susan B. Anthony Society for the Sisters of Gertrude Stein, as they sit in their renovated community center, sharing secrets as the threat of atomic apocalypse nibbles at their heels. Again, that's the Triangle Productions performance of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. For the last few years, I've attended the annual meetings of the Oregon Public Health Association. These have been taking place on the campus of Oregon State University in early October. I talked to leaders in the state and country about issues that concern public health people. In this program, the first of this series, I'll be talking with past President Brian Johnson and current President Lila Wickham of the Oregon Association, and with Joyce Coffin, President of the American Public Health Association. They'll tell us about the views of their members and about their concerns. Well, welcome to the program, Lila Wickham and Brian Johnson. Brian, you're the outgoing president of OPHA, and talked to you a year ago. And Lila, you're the president-elect, now president. It's sort of a three-year commitment. First the president-elect, and then you're the president, then you're the past president. But you work together so that there's continuity.
That's right.
Sounds like a good plan. So you're only in the hot seat for 1 year, really?
Yeah, you're really only in the hot seat 1 year, but then you share your time with each other and the leadership for the three-year term.
Well, the legislature is going to be having a real session again this year. You always have legislative goals, and I've been to one of the OPHA days. And this one's going to be April 9th, right? And so you'll be asking public health people and people interested or studying public health to come to the Capitol and talk to legislators and talk about the agenda.
Our typical strategy there is to come forward and really partly to advance just the idea of public health, so helping our legislators understand the value of it and the investment and what it can add in the health of our communities. And then, depending on what's brought forward, we may speak to those initiatives specifically, or we might introduce some ideas. We often invite folks to bring forward, from our membership and from the communities, bring forward ideas that they think we ought to consider.
I remember a group of young people coming, I think it was the last one that I attended, and it was very effective because some young people talked about what they were working on, and they were, I think, clubs in several different high schools. Well, Brian, in your comments yesterday, you mentioned a few bills that you had been advocating, and when I say you, I mean OPHA.
Yes.
Not you necessarily, but probably. And let's see if I have the numbers. Okay, SB 1551, and that was one on background checks.
Primarily, our focus there was on supporting the initiatives around gun safety and really highlighting the focus that there needed to be a little more understanding the public health implications of gun ownership and responsible ownership and how we might be able to protect the public. And that's where we were focusing our energy.
And another one was SB 1569. And the mention was something to do with chemicals.
I actually followed that one because I was previously the environmental health director, and that was one of our important issues, is exposure of chemicals to children. And the bill was actually to have disclosure lists so that people would be aware of what chemicals were in products.
Kind of a labeling.
Yeah, basically.
Interesting,
yes.
Yeah. Reminds me of one of the ballot measures, people's right to know what they're purchasing. In 1577.
It was kind of like the Amber Alert, but for elders. Oh. So that if an elder went missing, you would have a way to track them down. Because, you know, there are elders who have memory issues and they disappear and there's no way to find them. So it was kind of an Amber Alert bill for elders.
Oh, yeah. And we do read about those cases quite often. And, of course, we want elders to have freedom to move around and do things. I'm interested in the process. How does OPHA decide, talk about it among its large membership, about 500 members, and decide what bills or what general areas of emphasis? How do you do that?
So one of the first things we do, we invite folks. We put out a general invitation and say, please bring forward the issues you think have public health implications. And we ask them to describe the context of it and what they think those potential implications are. And then we have a committee among the general membership and also members of our board who review those recommendations among others that they bring forward. And they then bring those recommendations to our executive committee or to our board in general to consider. And it can be in everything from endorsing a particular initiative to providing our full support and serving on committees and those sorts of things. It really just depends on the particular topic.
So this takes, well, maybe it's an all-year process, but a little bit here, a little bit there. Is that the idea?
It can be throughout the year. We often have things come up any time of year. And it could be a local level initiative, it could be a statewide initiative. And generally we'll chime in for those things that we think have a strong public health implication. If they don't, we might step aside or remain neutral on the matter. But for the most part, we'll focus in on those that have a strong public health implications and we'll lend our support for that initiative.
You might give her the example of the Lane County.
For example, as a local level initiative this past year, we had in Lane County, and particularly in Eugene, is where this was happening. There was a discussion around paid sick leave. I don't know if you'll recall that. Portland, I believe, had already passed it at the time. So the city of Eugene was considering it, and we, as an organization, decided that we wanted to support that also. We had supported it in Portland. We lent our support in Eugene, and the way we did that is by making a statement on behalf of the organization, as well as inviting our local membership to speak and testify before the city council.
Very interesting. And I should mention that Brian is with the Lane County Public Health, a statistician or epidemiologist at any rate, and probably use a lot of statistics. And I remember we talked about GPS modeling that you do to track environments around the county. And Lila, you retired in Multnomah County as the environmental health director.
I was the environmental health director from 1999 to 2013.
A goodly long time. So you represent those two large metropolitan areas, really, in different aspects of public health and outreach. And now there are three measures. We're having an election very soon, of course, and you've chosen three. The OPHA has chosen three to support. One was no on the top two, and another was Measure 88. It's a referendum on a bill that would grant the right to be tested and be licensed as a driver to those people who have been a resident of the state for a year but do not have documentation or not, quote, legal immigrants as we normally think of it. And then the third one has to do with labeling. And that was what I was thinking about a minute ago when you're talking about labeling chemical products.
So this one is GM, genetically modified labeling. Those three were brought to us requesting our endorsement from various organizations. Mm-hmm. But back to your original question of how do you represent 500 people?
Yes.
That's really challenging. And so our process is for it to go to the policy committee. And then the policy committee makes a recommendation to the board. And the board is a 26-member board that represents every committee and the regions that you heard about. So you're never going to have complete consensus on what OPHA is supporting, but that's our model that we use to weigh in on what we believe to be our public health issues.
That's really excellent, it seems to me, because a more cowardly way would be to say, well, we just can't do it. We just can't go one way or another. But when something seems very strong in the minds of the board members and the members at large, then you go for it.
Mm-hmm. And I think the strength that we bring to the issue is that we are a 500-plus membership of public health professionals across the state who consider public health in their daily lives. So we can lend our voice to those issues that really make sense to offer that up.
And of course, you don't do anything about supporting any particular legislator or anything of that sort.
Not at all.
Well, it's great to be here at this meeting, and I thank you both for all your work, for serving as leaders.
Well, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Brian and Lila, thank you. For the second part of this program, I welcome Joyce Goffin, president of the American Public Health Association, who visited the conference and talked to students and talked to me. Welcome, Joyce.
Well, thank you, Roberta. I'm glad to be here in Corvallis today.
We're just at the edge. Probably our rain will be starting.
I come from the Southwest, so I know very much about the need for rain.
Southern Utah,
by Zion National Park.
Well, that's a wonderful place. Well, you've been traveling a lot as the president. I remember you said something about 30 states.
This is my 29th state affiliate visit, and I've had two trips to Taiwan and Tokyo, and I spent 3 weeks in India last year and a week in Canada, so I have been on the road a lot.
Charlie Fountain of our Benton County Health Department was just saying that a president is expected to visit affiliates at least 17. You've really hit the mark.
It's been my pleasure. I like being to the affiliate meetings because these are the people who represent the best in public health practice. They're people who work in state and local agencies, nonprofits, our partners in the academic community. Being here on campus has been a really lovely experience, both a beautiful campus and a great new school of public health here at OSU. And I just spent some time with students, and that's one of the favorite parts of my visits.
And that was a workshop that you did this noon.
Now, it was really more of an informal lunch, but I did talk a little bit about engaging students in leadership in public health. They're very eager and ready to get going.
And a lot of them, I think, see public health as a way to interact with people on a lot of other topics, on topics that the general public does not see as public health.
This is true. Trying to define what public health is really difficult to the general public. When we tell them about specific programs that we do in public health, they're very much in favor of these things. Food safety programs, looking at the environment, healthy children programs, and all of these things that they don't necessarily see every day, they don't recognize as public health. So that's always one of our challenges, is trying to, as my friend Dr. Barry Levy, a former president of APHA, said once, we need to put the public back in public health so they understand what we do.
The public good, and not just sewers, which are, of course, very important, but not the whole thing. So when we were talking about some of the things that you are interested in, you mentioned universal health care that is being pushed for by a substantial number of people in our state. Have you noticed that going on in other states as you visited them?
There are some other states. I know in Vermont, some of the northeastern states, they've been very engaged in creating a health for all effort. APHA's policies represent and reflect our agreement that a policy on universal health coverage is not only healthy for individuals, but it is healthy for our nation. There are still so many gaps, even with the passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which is often called Obamacare. I feel that there are so many people that are still in gaps. And I think we have a very teachable moment right now with the Ebola issue out there, where people are really wondering, you know, is our public health system, are our health care systems structured, safe, and well-trained to protect us? Do we know how to protect ourselves? And what do we do for people who may be afraid to go to an emergency room because they don't have health care coverage and they're afraid of what it could cost them? And we know that it could cost us all a very lot without them having access to these kinds of services.
Right. That's a great example. just a week or so ago on campus, we had someone speaking on the concept of One Health. I don't know if you're familiar with it. I wasn't. It has to do with looking at the health of the environment, health of animals, and the health of people together. And it was an epidemiologist from the national parks who was speaking about this, and he gave an example of where, in kind of your part of the country but not your state, a mountain lion was found dead by a wildlife biologist. He assumed it had been killed by another animal, and he got into it and did a necropsy. He didn't use gloves, and he didn't use anything else. This was a little less than 10 years ago, and the upshot is he died of plague because he hadn't been thinking about plague that is in the environment, in a number of rodents at least, and maybe some other animals, and this was, I think, a septicemic type. And also that, of course, it affects people, and it just set them all thinking about these connections. And of course, what came to my mind was, wish we'd had those concepts in Africa, because gorillas have been dying for decades in very large numbers. Of course, there's bushmeat and various other things. So I really think talking about Ebola, but not in a scary way, but just in a way that people need to understand that these things are international. They move very quickly, or can move very quickly, and one little slip up, who knows?
I come from Utah, and I would say that Utah and Oregon have both very strong healthcare systems and public health systems. We're very fortunate, having been around the world and having a chance to look at systems across the United States, we're on the cutting edge. Oregon is certainly on the cutting edge, leading on this concept of universal coverage and an accountable outcomes-based healthcare system that focuses on real improvement in health. And this is essential because the United States, contrary to what a lot of people might believe, is really falling behind other peer nations, other industrialized nations, in terms of how well we do in the outcomes we get in our health, how long people are living, how well they're living. These are real challenges for us. Public health tries to address that. Right now, we are trying to take a look at the outcomes-based proposals that are a part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And I like to put the patient protection in there because many of the things that have occurred in our health system are to really help patients be safer when they're receiving health care and get better quality for the health care that they're getting. And we're trying to work in partnership with our health care providers to take the best of what public health knows how to do, which is to help people be healthier. The typical definition for public health is what we as a society do collectively to ensure conditions in which people can be healthy, and how individual responsibility plays in, plus our environment, the built environment that we live in, and trying to provide equity so that everybody has an opportunity to achieve the best possible health outcomes in their lives.
So you think Oregon is really doing pretty well?
I think Oregon is doing quite well. Every year there are state health rankings, and Oregon is in the top part of that. And a lot of this has to do with the strength of our public health systems and access to care. And in our big western states, and there's a lot of territory west of the Mississippi, so often we have rural and frontier areas. And even in some of the most populated states, New York, for instance, has rural and frontier areas. We really have special needs of making sure that access is available to people, both in terms of having insurance or other coverage so they can afford the health care, but that they have a way to get to the health care and that it's quality care when they receive it.
I just was in a session talking about rural areas and access to things like physical education. I shouldn't call it physical education. You know, exercise and fun, hikes and games and all the rest of it that sometimes are lacking in more rural areas for reasons that are sort of unclear. Part of it is, of course, if there's a really great trail 15 miles away from you, but you don't have a car or you don't have access to a car, too bad. Or if your roads are poor, and so bicycling isn't allowed by the parents because they don't think it's a good idea.
We need to design our communities so that we can have transportation. People have alternative kinds of transportation. But the built environment, the communities we live in, really do impact how well we can be healthy. Corvallis and where I come from in St. George, Utah, are extremely good examples of how communities come together and are based on ensuring that people have access to a robust variety of things that they can do as individuals and as families and as an entire community. Contrary to that, there are places in the country that have massive problems. For example, when I was in Los Angeles last December, I was at the old LA County General Hospital, which has been closed down as a hospital, and they built a new hospital next door. This is in the Boyle Heights area of LA, which is next to East LA, and it's one of the toughest, hardest, most challenging neighborhoods. It's rampant with gangs. There's great differentiation in the population in terms of the gangs, and most of them are quite underserved individuals. They've taken the old hospital, the old LA County General Hospital, and they have turned it into a community wellness center. And they have 18 nonprofit and community level groups, everything from the MS Society to the Heart Association to classes to help people learn how to cook food healthier. They have on-site food markets because they live in a food desert right there in the middle of LA. And they've taken this enclosed, beautiful campus and they've designed it so that people from the community in Boyle Heights can come in there and a mom can bring her kids and have a safe and secure place to take her baby for a walk in a stroller and go shop for some fresh food and take a class that will teach her how to cook healthier foods, get her children immunized, perhaps they work together in a dance program where they're getting exercise, all in a safe environment, because you can't do this on the streets in Boyle Heights in LA.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful development and something that probably could be exported conceptually. The health department here has Latino soccer games for 2 days every summer. I've only been to it once. On one day, they invited a lot of health-related groups to come so that the Lions Club with their testing of eyes was there and people from the health department and various health advocacy groups in this really fun atmosphere talking to people. It isn't a safety issue in that park, fortunately, at all. It's a park that people do visit other times as well. That's just a kind of a way to bring people together to accomplish a lot of things.
I think one of the things that people need to know about public health is it's a very complicated system because there are so many moving parts in public health. And it operates at an international, federal, state, local, regional level. Most people know very little about what's available to them through their local health departments. I encourage people to find out. It's more than food handlers and just the immunization programs and so on. There are so many health-promoting activities you can get. Our health departments are trying to work in a more systemic and partnership fashion, collaborative fashion, with healthcare providers, because healthcare providers have a real challenge. They can come in and treat people when they're sick. We call it a sick care system instead of a health care system. We want people to get to health. And to do that, people have a certain individual responsibility in taking care of themselves. And we, as communities, need to work together to ensure that they have the right kinds of access to care when they need it, but ways to stay healthy. And so systemically, we are trying to balance out all of these different moving parts. Your example of the cougar was a great one because that's a systems thinking perspective. What happens far away actually impacts and influences our health right here today. So when we think in that way and people wonder why it's not easy to get things done and it's not quick to get things done, and it may not always be done exactly the right way, we don't have absolute standards for everything across the country. There are a lot of local considerations, and it's a big and moving system. For years, we've been saying that some of our most senior people in public health would be leaving the system, and we need to get in and train the new people that are coming in. So we constantly have a turnover. In APHA, we have several priorities. One is certainly ensuring health equity. The next one is that the work we do is science and evidence-based, and we are finding these days some people don't have the same value for science and evidence-based research and practice as they did in previous days. I have said it a lot of times, you know, I think it's quite sad when people would listen to a former playmate about vaccine efficacy and safety instead of the Surgeon General or the director of the CDC in the United States. That's a shame, because they do things that are science and evidence-based. But then again, we've got this need to build our public health infrastructures. We always say in public health, people don't know us, because as long as everything is going right, they truly forget what we're doing. But in an event like we're having right now, not only with Ebola, but with the enterovirus, which is probably more dangerous to the average family by far because of the implications that we're having with children who are passing away from this, we need to have that infrastructure in place. We need these strong partnerships. We need these strong public health departments that will be there when you need them. And they're doing things every day that you don't see, but they're helping you and your family stay healthy.
Tell us just a little about the enterovirus.
Well, I'm not an expert. That's not my field. And so I would defer to someone who has more medical training. But again, it's a virus that comes and goes. And right now there's an outbreak in almost all states in the country. And it's particularly impacting children, young children. Like all viruses, they can be transmitted very quickly and people don't know about it. My understanding is that there's not a vaccine program for the enterovirus. But it's also flu season, and I would remind people that everybody needs to participate. There are some people who cannot have vaccines and they rely on herd immunity, so that the rest of us who can have the vaccinations should be getting vaccinated against flu, pneumonia, and all of our other required vaccines, so that we can ensure that condition where other people can be healthy. So if you haven't gotten your flu shot or the flu mist, this is a good time to get started before it starts to spread.
Well, just a few questions about your own background. How did you get interested in this field, and how long have you been working in it? Because you certainly have the passion for it.
I do have passion for public health, and most of the people do, because people who work in public health, it's not a particularly glamorous field. We often feel like we work in bureaucracies where we're fighting fires and banging our head against a wall, but people who work in public health hope to make a difference, and sometimes our work takes a long time before we can see the actual differences. I got a start when I was working in the Utah Department of Health. I came in an administrative capacity back in 1973. I advanced. I worked in the Medicaid program in our community and local health programs. I was a program manager, but my biggest part of my job was workforce development. So I'm really interested in ensuring training for our public health workforce, and I was a disaster coordinator at the Utah Department of Health, and so I'm very interested in all of the things that people can be aware of right now and how we prepare ourselves for any kinds of disasters, including disease outbreaks that can come up. I eventually directed the Great Basin Public Health Leadership Institute, which was a Utah-Nevada partnership, and I did that for 8 years, and then I was elected to this position, and I have been doing this now as president-elect and president for almost 2 years. I have one more year to go, and it has been the best possible thing to be out working with all the people that are protecting our health every day of the year.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you very much, Joyce Goffin, and I'm glad that you were able to make this site one of your visits this year, because you're adding a lot to this conference.
Thank you, Roberta. I'm glad to be here, and I hope to come back as a visitor.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Lori Childers and played by Lori Childers and Kent White.
And that concludes the Monday Morning Radio Zine. Thank you for listening, and do stay tuned. We have the Noontime Jamboree coming up after the noon headlines here on KBOO Portland.
And now for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, November 17th, 2014. The death of a Palestinian bus driver at the hands of unknown assailants has led to renewed protests in the city of Jerusalem. The bus driver was found covered in bruises and hanging from a bar in the bus by his bow tie. But Israeli police ruled the death a suicide, further angering the Palestinian citizens of Jerusalem. This attack came just as the Israeli human rights group Yesh Din issued a report that 92% of Israeli attacks against Palestinians are never prosecuted. Residents of the area around St. Louis, Missouri, are on edge as the grand jury in the case of Darren Wilson prepares to release its verdict. Darren Wilson is the officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown in August, sparking local and national protests against police violence and racism. A doctor from Sierra Leone who had contracted Ebola and was sent to Nebraska for treatment has died. Martin Salia had received both the controversial ZMapp drug and a blood transfusion from a survivor of the virus, but the Ebola virus was apparently too far along when the treatments were administered. His death marks the second fatality from Ebola in the U.S. Both men who have died from the virus in this country contracted it while in West Africa. The U.S. government has announced an expansion of screenings of people entering the country from Mali, in addition to those from Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. The precautionary measure comes after three people were confirmed to have the virus in Mali. 440 people who had contact with those three are now being monitored for signs of the deadly virus. And that's it for the KBOO News at Noon. Tune in every weekday at 5 for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer news teams right here in our Portland studios.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the Noontime Jamboree. Come on, come on, come on, come on.
Now, boys, I come down here to drown my sorrow. Ain't going home till tomorrow.